professionals were especially concerned is because Trump would appear to be part of the cohort most at risk, as he has a common heart disease. Yes, he doesn't have one.
Beautiful. What a nickel.
It's empty. The tinsmith forgot to give me a heart.
No heart?
No heart. All hollow. When a man's an empty kettle, he should be on his mettle, and yet I'm torn apart. Just because I'm presuming that I could be kind of human if I only had a heart. I'd be tender, I'd be gentle, and awful sentimental regarding love and art. I'd be friends with the sparrows and the boy who shoots the arrows if I only had a heart. Picture me a balcony above a boy sings low.
Wherefore art thou, Romeo?
I hear a beat. How sweet, just to register emotion, jealousy, devotion, and really feel the part. I could stay young and chipper, and I'd lock it with a zipper, if I only had a heart.
Despite a statement by the White House doctor, some people are speculating the president might be lying.
Let me assure you, the president of the United States is not taking hydroxychloroquine.
This president doesn't tell the truth. He may be taking this, he may not.
Or option C, his doctors decided it was just easier to let him think he's taking it. Every morning I push back Spider-Man's head and a little hydroxychloroquine comes out. Right now they're blue, but next week's prescription is orange. But if that's true, hydroxychloroquine is just part of a long-standing policy of ingesting whatever product he endorses. It wasn't just doctors who were shocked at Trump self-medicating. We also heard from Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi.
Madam Speaker, what's your reaction to the president saying that he's now taking hydroxychloroquine? Are you concerned?
He's our president, and I would rather he not be taking something that has not been approved by the scientist, especially in his age group and in his, shall we say, weight group, what is morbidly obese, they say.
Oh, that is a very polite way to say a mean thing. I'm concerned about the president because he is, shall we say, 20 pounds of pudding in a 10-pound sack. What I'm saying is, your president is so fat that when he sits around the White House, he, and shall I put this diplomatically, sits around the White House, which is a very, very large building indeed. And it's important to point out that fat shaming is wrong. Plenty of wonderful people are old and fat and beloved, like Santa. But guess what? Santa shouldn't take hydroxychloroquine either. But if Trump really is taking hydroxychloroquine, he might not only be endangering himself, because Trump's got legions of followers eager to jump on the hydroxychloro wagon. So yesterday, Fox News' Neil Cavuto gave him this stern warning.
If you are in a risky population here and you are taking this as a preventative treatment, it will kill you. I cannot stress enough. This will kill you.
No, Neil, bad. I cannot stress this enough. Fox anchors have to back up everything Trump says or else. Now, Trump wasn't about to take this slight from Neil lying down, although he was almost certainly lying down when he retweeted half a dozen Twitter posts attacking Cavuto, calling him an idiot, foolish, gullible, and an ass. There you have it. Trying to keep elderly people alive now makes you an idiot in Trump's book. Trump is still trying to find someone he can blame his poor response to the pandemic on. So far, he's narrowed it down to China, Obama, and anyone not named Donald Trump.
I know, I'll blame it on the dog. What do you mean I don't have a dog? Then who pooped on the rug?
Last night, Trump lashed out at one of his favorite blame targets, threatening in a letter to the Director General of the World Health Organization that he would permanently end all funding to the organization if it did not commit to substantive improvements. No surprise there. The WHO combines everything Trump hates, the world, health, and organization. Trump's real target is China and their handling of the coronavirus. That's why his letter includes this little tidbit.
On January 28th, 2020, after meeting with President Xi in Beijing, you praised the Chinese government for its transparency with respect to coronavirus.
Yeah, and I seem to remember one member of the WHO on January 24th really going over the top with their praise of China.
China has been working very hard to contain the coronavirus. The United States greatly appreciates their efforts and transparency. It will all work out well. In particular, on behalf of the American people, I want to thank President Xi.
Well, that tweet hasn't aged very well. Trump feels the WHO is too close to China, so he's cutting off their funding. China had another idea, because also yesterday, President Xi Jinping offered to provide $2 billion in the fight against the pandemic and called on other nations to increase their contributions to the WHO. Take that, China! Trump just made you the world leader in fighting this pandemic. He's got you right where you want you.
Preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.
So did you hear this nasty, like I don't even want to say it, it's so nasty, thing that Sleepy Joe said today? He was on The Breakfast Club, not the one with the white kids from the 80s, but the one with Charlemagne the God. This guy, great Christian, it was on this program this morning. And if I had said what he said, obviously the media would be going, the fake news, you would be going insane right now. But Sleepy Joe, who must have not had his cup of coffee to be regular sleepy, because he was obviously extra sleepy in his creepy basement, he said, if the blacks don't vote for Sleepy Joe, they're no longer the blacks. This is what, that's what he said. It's a disgusting statement, and I can't believe it. I would never say that, okay? I respect the blacks a tremendous amount, okay? In fact, when I'm not around them, I use the N-word, which, as you know, right, is a term of endearment, okay? That's the kind of relationship I have with the African-American community. I'll call them the N-word in private. Like when Kanye had that song, remember Gold Digger? It's a great song. Mike, you remember Gold Digger? It's a great, you know, the one with the, who she's not messing with. I wrote the messing with line, okay? No, excuse me, I did. Kanye said, what should come after? I'm not saying she's a gold digger. And I said, believe me, I've got the line to deliver right after that, okay? And I gave him the line, believe me. So, as you can see, in solidarity with the blacks, I'm wearing a sticker on my MAGA hat. Because you ever see them walking around with the sticker? It's like a cultural thing. They put the sticker on the hat, and it sort of means you're part of the club or something. So, Joe Biden, Sleepy Joe, is a nasty racist, and Hunter Biden was in China and started the coronavirus.
From the Wave Farm Radio Art Archive, you're about to hear a piece called Swan by the American electroacoustic composer Yvette Janine Jackson. Jackson creates what she refers to as radio opera. Her work borrows from the immersive sound of the golden age of radio drama, and is meant to be listened to in the dark to animate the theater of the mind. Yvette Janine Jackson is also interested in an African-American aesthetic of electroacoustic music, influenced by Afrofuturism. Her piece Swan takes place in three scenes, quote, the cargo hold of a tall ship transporting Africans to the Americas, a disorienting journey that traverses time, and the arrival into the weightlessness of outer space, end quote. Swan is just under 11 minutes long. You just heard Yvette Janine Jackson's radio opera Swan. For more information about this piece and to learn about many other radio artworks, please visit the Wave Farm Radio Art Archive at wavefarm.org.
This past week, Rensselaer County renewed its contract with the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Office under the 287 agreement. Our partner station WOOC and correspondent Elizabeth Press spoke with Zach Ahmad and Melanie Trimble from the New York Civil Liberties Union about what this means.
Today we are talking about 287G with policy counselor for the New York Civil Liberties Union, Zach Ahmad, and Melanie Trimble, the New York Civil Liberties Union Capital Region Chapter Director. Thank you both for joining us on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine today.
Thank you for having us.
In general terms, what is 287G?
Sure. So the 287G program is a federal program created under federal immigration law. So it's a formal program that puts correction officers under the supervision of ICE supervisors and has them performing a number of immigration-related tasks, which could include issuing immigration detainers, which are pieces of paper asking that a person be held, detaining people for civil immigration purposes, inquiring and investigating people's immigration statuses who come into local jails, and transporting people on behalf of ICE. It essentially makes local officers de facto ICE agents and puts them under the control of ICE for certain purposes. Generally, local authorities do not have the authority to enforce immigration law absent the cooperation and direction of ICE. 287G is a program that allows them to do that.
Zach Ahmad, can you go into this a little bit further? Like, how did local law enforcement and ICE start these programs in collaboration?
The 287G program was created by federal law in 1996. ICE only has so many resources, and so it is beneficial to them when they can have the assistance of local authorities investigating immigration offenses and assisting them with immigration enforcement. We do not think that is the proper role of local authorities. The role of local authorities should be to serve their communities and enforce local laws and protect community well-being.
Here in Rensselaer County, we are the only county in New York State that participates in this 287G contract. Sheriff Russo just renewed this 287G contract. Melanie Trimble, could you talk about how specifically 287G affects us here in Rensselaer County?
Well, that's a very good question because we have found out very little information from the sheriff about its use. We don't know how many people have been captured by the program. We don't know how many officers are participating in the program. We don't know how much money the county is spending to participate in the agreement. All of this information was requested of the sheriff in a letter that we sent a few weeks ago. The sheriff acknowledged receipt of the letter, but never responded to the concerns that we had, despite our asking in several forms for a meeting. It's a little disconcerting to have a county official not answering questions that are coming from their constituents. And we certainly would welcome a conversation about how it's being used at the jail.
And Melanie Trimble, on behalf of the New York Civil Liberties Union, you had an opinion piece published in the Times Union this week ahead of the renewal. Is this in response for not getting a response from your direct communication with the sheriff's office?
Yes. We wanted to make it public that we have asked the sheriff for these specific questions about the program, and he has refused to answer. There are several community groups that are interested in having a conversation with the sheriff, and we hope to address that. It, part of the agreement states that the sheriff will hold a public meeting to discuss the program with. That happened once, but it was not really a conversation. It was a PowerPoint presentation, and we would like to have a more thorough and robust conversation with the sheriff over the program.
One thing that stood out to me from your op-ed was a statement that said most law enforcement agencies recognize the 287G contract undermine public safety. I was wondering if you could speak to that.
As much as the sheriff assures us that it's only a correctional officer or two and that their jurisdiction will only be in the jail, it sends a chilling effect out into the community that there are some law enforcement individuals that are enforcing local law enforcement of immigration law. And it makes anybody, not even just people that are not documented, we're talking about anybody who looks a little different or sounds a little different, you know, is very afraid to interface with law enforcement because of the fact that they may be captured and held and maybe even shipped off to Batavia. And the mistakes have been made, particularly in Rensselaer County. And so we're very concerned. We do believe that having law enforcement participate in any capacity in a 287G agreement causes a lot of discomfort within the communities and discourages cooperation with law enforcement. It makes police officers' jobs more difficult to have people hide from them and not want to engage during investigations or even calling for emergency services.
How is community involvement and other 287G contracts, is there a usual way that is supposed to play out?
Community outreach is something that is embedded into every 287G agreement. There are provisions that require jurisdictions to hold steering committee meetings and to engage in other community outreach as appropriate. And this has been an area of critique over the 287G program. New York is not the only place where there's a lack of transparency. And in fact, the Department of Homeland Security's Office of Inspector General has specifically criticized the 287G program in the past for its lack of transparency and the failure to use the steering committee process to meaningfully engage members of the community. And that's something that at minimum needs to change. Certainly, we think the sheriff's office, which can sever the 287G agreement at any time, even though it was just renewed. What we want is for Rensselaer County to not engage in 287G and to withdraw from the contract. But while they're doing so, at the very least, they have to be engaging the community more meaningfully, holding regular meetings, allowing stakeholders to not just be present in the audience at a public meeting, but to actually have a seat at the table and share information and help shape how the 287G program is operating, if it needs to operate at all, which of course we do not think it does.
In the 2 years since Sheriff Russo made this deal with ICE, it seems like there's not a lot of information. Public safety, you're saying, is a concern, especially for immigrant families. And it also has been said that there's drain on local resources. Could you speak to that last point? Who pays for 287G?
That is one of the pieces where we'd like there to be more transparency because there is some mixed information. But what's important to note is that counties do not get paid to participate in the 287G program. This is not something that is in any way some kind of revenue raiser for the county. There are certain costs associated with attending trainings. There are certain equipment upgrades that are required in order to install the software that ICE needs to use to effectuate immigration enforcement at the local level. But I think what's important to note is that when we're talking about resources, we're not just talking about literal dollars and cents that are cost to the county. We're talking about the way in which the county's attention and the sheriff's office's attention is diverted from other matters. When they are deciding voluntarily to engage in this program that no other law enforcement agency in the state is engaging in, to deputize their officers to perform immigration law, they are necessarily taking those officers' attention away from what should be their core duties and having them focus on immigration law instead. And immigration law is something that's very complex. That is why there's certain training required under 287G, but really the minimal training that's required under the program.
We'll be right back. Hi, I'm Rachel T.
Hi, I'm Eva.
Hi, I'm Rachel G.
We are all Girl Scouts, and this is WGXC ACRA.
Hay acciones cotidianas para ayudar a prevenir la propagación de enfermedades respiratorias. Lávese las manos. Evite el contacto cercano con las personas enfermas. Evite tocarse los ojos, la nariz y la boca. Quédese en casa cuando esté enfermo. Cúbrase al toser o estornudar. Limpie y desinfecte de manera frecuente los objetos que toca. Para obtener más información, visite cdc.gov/COVID-19. Este mensaje es gentileza de la National Association of Broadcasters y de esta estación.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Mid-Hudson Cable, serving Columbia, Greene, and Southern Albany counties with digital cable, high-speed internet, and cable phone services for homes and businesses since 1971. Mid-Hudson Cable, all the right connections on the web at mhcable.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Jack Sensabaugh of Catskill, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You, too, can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
You're listening to Wireless Reconnaissance, Broadcast Surveillance, Transmission Art, and more, Saturdays on WGXC 90.7 FM Creative Community Radio.
Stay at home, stay alive, organize, organize. I am Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. We're between two historical epochs now, BC and AC, before COVID-19 and after COVID-19. Established institutions, entrenched regimes, and powerful corporations are well positioned to navigate the uncharted waters of this in-between DC or during COVID-19 time. Less equipped are the poor and working class, unable to gather safely to protest, to rally for better conditions. The novel coronavirus has amplified the gross inequality that dominates our society. Just look at the disconnect between the stock market and the plight of workers. It seems with every announcement of historic job losses, the Dow Jones and the S&P 500 shoot upward. On Wall Street, they're counting gains, while on Main Street, they're digging graves.
These are hard times.
That's Reverend William Barber II. He was speaking Wednesday on the Democracy Now! NewsHour.
A lot of the pain is by choice. It didn't have to be. It's not because of the virus, per se. It is because of the pandemic of greed and lies and trickle-down economics that in this situation caused us to move in the wrong direction from the beginning. Even before COVID hit, too many people were too comfortable with other people's deaths. We had 140 million poor, low-income people in this country, 43% of the nation, 700 people dying a day from poverty and low wealth, 250,000 a year, even before COVID hit.
Reverend Barber is co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign and president of the nonprofit Repairers of the Breach. He and campaign co-chair Reverend Liz Thea Harris of the Union Theological Seminary are calling on people from all walks of life to join a digital online mass poor people's assembly and moral march on Washington on June 20th at june2020.org.
Don't you believe these lies these governors are telling us and about the time to open back up the society? Stay at home, stay alive, organize.
Despite the incredible challenges, despite the demands to stay at home for those fortunate enough to stay at home, people are organizing and taking creative and courageous action. As has been the case throughout U.S. history, movements drive change. Now is no exception. Shortly after his interview on Democracy Now!, Barber spoke at a virtual mass action, a nationwide strike staged by workers at McDonald's restaurants. Fast food workers there and at other restaurant chains have been organizing the Fight for 15 campaign for a living wage for years. That's $15 an hour. One worker after another spoke on the live video stream detailing the challenges and risks they face daily as part of our sprawling, underpaid, and virtually ignored essential workforce.
And I'm a McDonald's worker here in Kansas City, Missouri.
That's Fred Marion.
And I'm going on strike because as you see me and listen to me, I am human just like you. I may not be a doctor or a paramedic, but I'm out here on the front lines just like them. And I'm human just like them. We deserve PPE, hazard pay, health care. $15 is just a living wage, and isn't even the proper living wage for us. I just deserve to be treated like a human, and that's why I'm going on strike.
Angelica Hernandez spoke in Spanish.
Pues la verdad. McDonald's.
Inspired to strike by her coworker who is stricken by COVID-19 and is currently on a ventilator. McDonald's, she said, showed no interest in providing protective gear for workers. Katara Wilkins added,
people can get it. Anybody can get it. So I think it's kind of dangerous. And we're risking our lives to work for $7.25.
In solidarity with striking workers were speakers like Mary Kay Henry, international president of SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, and epidemiologist David Michaels, who served as head of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration under President Obama. New York Democratic Senator Kirsten Gillibrand spoke, pointing out that
even after Congress passed an emergency paid sick leave law in March, 75% of workers were left out, thanks to carve-outs for big businesses like McDonald's. If they or a loved one gets sick, they have to face an impossible choice between their family's economic security and its health. That is not a choice that any of us should be forced to make. It's a failure in policy. If you can't afford to stay home when you're sick, that's a problem for you and everyone you come in contact with when you're at work. Making sure everyone can afford to stay home when they are their most contagious is crucial to combating this virus.
Meanwhile, in front of McDonald's corporate headquarters in Chicago, activists installed a symbolic picket line of sign-holding, cardboard silhouettes of striking workers. The ACLU drove an electronic billboard truck through the streets of downtown Chicago, broadcasting the workers' demand for a living wage. These are difficult, dangerous times. Armed, overwhelmingly white, right-wing vigilantes storm state capitals, while the undocumented, the poor, communities of color, those most at risk keep our economy moving, growing our food, working in slaughterhouses and warehouses, delivering packages and meals, cleaning our hospitals and caring for our elderly. They face COVID-19 infection on a daily basis with practically no safety net. Whatever future we collectively forge in the after COVID-19 era, the needs of these essential workers and of the poor must be front and center. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
German measles, Russian flu, Montezuma's revenge. And why do we say a foreign word whenever someone sneezes?
Tomorrow, I'll take a look at swine flu up close and personal. This is Les Nesbitt.
The radio pieces you're about to hear from the Wave Farm Radio Art Archive were created by Tony Schwartz. For over 30 years, Tony Schwartz produced weekly radio programs about sound for the New York City public radio station, WNYC. Schwartz also created records for Smithsonian Folkways that feature his distinct style, described as part anthropological study, part hometown travelogue. Schwartz developed a portable tape recording setup in the 1950s, which enabled him to collect sounds outside the studio. So he did recordings in the streets of New York and also in his home. He edits and presents his pieces in a very distinct way. Plus, Tony Schwartz is very likable. A tenderness, humor, curiosity, and intimacy come through in his pieces. A poignant detail is that He was agoraphobic and rarely traveled outside his New York City neighborhood. His recordings create an expansive sonic world. The first of these three pieces by Tony Schwartz is called Favorite Sounds and was recorded at the Jewish Guild for the Blind in New York City in 1963. The second features the voices of New York City teenagers and is called How We Remember, produced in 1970. And the third piece in this selection of works by Tony Schwartz is about the pleasures of sound and is called Music in Marble Halls from 1962.
Good morning, Tom. The other evening, I was invited to the New York Guild for the Jewish Blind to present sound and sound stories to a number of elderly people. And as part of the evening, I recorded these people telling their names and their favorite sound or their most beautiful sound that they could think of.
My name is Morris Feldman.
And what is your favorite sound?
Classical music.
My name is Frieda London,
and what
I'd like to say is that sounds and voices mean very, very much to blind people. Mm-hmm. Can almost tell the character of a person.
My name is Alex Rothman, and my beautiful sound would be Nice Music.
Marguerite Thomas, the sound I love is music.
My name is Victor Light. One of my favorite sounds is the voice of my father and mother.
My name is Leah Behar, and I love the sound of the whistling of the birds in the morning.
My name is Margaret Doherty. I like the sound of music, all kinds of music.
The sound of activity, of day's activity coming to a quiet end.
My name is Bill Sheeter. My favorite sound is music.
My name is Jimmy Palizzi, and I like the sound of church bells.
My name is Sophie McConaughey. I love the sound of children playing and of music.
My name is Anna Rabinovich, and I like the birds. Just very, very much I like the birds.
Hello, my name is Tilly Temsky. My favorite is to be in the chorus. That is my best fish to be.
My name is Julia Twyman. I like the sound of church bells chiming.
I like the sound of children laughing. I'm telling jokes.
My name is Mary Schmidt, and I think running water is the nicest sound that I know. A brook.
My favorite sound is the clinking, the feel of dollar bills. The bigger the denomination, the better the sound.
Well, I think this last gentleman was just kidding us. I think, in fact, he had written a beautiful poem about the sound of, I believe it was his mother's voice. I think that on your program you play a lot of the music that these people love, but I thought this morning I might just play a few sounds that they spoke of just to listen to and to enjoy. The first sound is the sound of a country brook. And the next one is for those listeners who like the birds in the morning. And the last one this morning is the sound of the church bells that many people love, and there are a lot of them in our city, and they go like this. Well, I hope some of our blind friends enjoyed those sounds, and this is Tony Schwartz saying, see you soon, Tom. Good morning. Here's a story I recorded the other day that a young teenager told me.
I got up early this morning, put on my polka-dotted tie and jacket, had breakfast, rode to Dalton.
And here's another one that another teenager told me.
After putting on my blue and gray spotted tie, I took my black bicycle downstairs and hopped on it and rode two blocks down to the 86th Street crosstown, and then rode across the transfers where I almost was run over by a bus, an 18 crosstown bus. And then I got to school and I went up the elevator. I shouldn't have done.
Any resemblance between the two? Well, there's an interesting story behind this story, or these stories. And the story is this, that it's the same story as passed on through 13 teenagers. And here's the whole process exactly as it happened.
After putting on my blue and gray spotted tie, I took my black bicycle downstairs and hopped on it and rode two blocks down to the 86th Street crosstown, and then rode across the transfers where I almost was run over by a bus, an 18 crosstown bus. And then I got to school and I went up the elevator. I shouldn't have done.
When I got up this morning to put on my blue and gray polka dot tie, went downstairs and jumped on my bike and went two blocks down to 86th Street crosstown. I swear I was almost hit by a 18 crosstown bus. And then I got to school and took the elevator upstairs, which I shouldn't have done.
I got up this morning and I put on my blue and white polka dotted shirt and my blue and white polka dotted tie, and I went downstairs and I got on my bicycle and I rode down to 86th Street, and I went into my school and I went up and I went upstairs and I took the elevator, which I shouldn't have.
I woke up this morning and I put on my blue and white polka dotted shirt and my blue and white polka dotted tie, and I went downstairs and I ate my breakfast, and I went out and got my bicycle and bicycled up to 86th Street, and I went into the school and took the elevator when I shouldn't have.
I woke up at 6:30 this morning. I put on my white and blue polka dotted shirt and my white and blue polka dotted tie, and I had breakfast, and I got my bicycle, and I went uptown to 86th Street, and I went to school, and I took the elevator when I shouldn't have.
I woke up at 6:30 this morning, and I put on my white and blue polka dotted shirt and my white and blue polka dotted tie, and I had my breakfast, and then I got my bicycle, and I went to school, and I went up to 86th Street. Then I went to school, and I took the elevator when I shouldn't have.
I woke up this morning about 6:30, and I put on my polka dot tie and my polka dot shirt, and I had breakfast, and I got my bicycle, and I went to school, and at 86th Street, and I took the elevator upstairs, and I shouldn't have.
I got up at 6:30, and I put on my polka dotted tie and my polka dotted shirt, and then I ate breakfast, and I got my bike, and I rode to school on 86th Street, and then I went to school, and I shouldn't have.
I got up at 8:30, and I got my breakfast, and I put on my polka dotted tie and my polka dotted shirt, and then I got on my bike, and I went to school on 89th Street, and when I shouldn't have.
I got up early this morning, and I got out of bed, and I put on my polka dotted tie and my shirt and jacket, and I had breakfast, and I rode my bike to school on 89th Street where I shouldn't have.
I got up early this morning, and I put on my shirt, and I put on my polka dotted tie and my jacket, and I went in and I had breakfast, and then I went to school, and I rode my bike down 89th Street where I shouldn't have.
I got up early this morning, and I put on my polka dotted tie and my shirt and my jacket, and had breakfast, and rode my bike down 89th Street where I shouldn't have.
I got up early this morning, put on my polka dotted tie and jacket, had breakfast, rode to Dalton.
Well, that's how stories, rumors, folklore, or history can be passed on.
something to think about. See you soon.
Have you ever heard railroad train wheels rolling along the rails, clickety-clack, clickety-clack, and thought how musical they sound, and that a musician could play beautiful music to the rhythm of these wheels? Well, recently I had the privilege of being able to take our country's top jazz clarinetist out into real-life situations and have him improvise against the sounds in these situations. The clarinetist is Mr. Jimmy Giuffre, and here is Mr. Giuffre playing against the rhythm of dripping water in the kitchen sink. A comment from Mr. Giuffre tells how he feels playing in this manner.
Well, it was a natural thrill to play music into natural sounds. The sounds of the city are, they have a thrill to them, an excitement that is very different from playing in a concert hall or a nightclub and just playing music to combine with the sounds around you is a very unusual experience.
Have you ever shouted from a hilltop and heard your echo? Or have you ever traveled through a tunnel and blown your automobile horn as you drove? The effects of different acoustics are interesting. Well, I wanted to record Mr. Giuffre in situations that would affect the sound of his clarinet in an unusual manner. Here, Mr. Giuffre walks the length of a large marble-lined hall, and as he walks, he plays his clarinet. Mr. Giuffre's comment about this experience.
Well, that felt the best because my own particular physical needs when I play have always leaned towards deep resonance, halls that had a lot of echo to them. And I play much better under those conditions. I have a difficult time in what you'd call a dry acoustics outside or in a flat place that's well padded. I like to hear the sound come back to me. So that was really a thrill in that enormous hall.
I'd like to end our adventures in sound with our experiment's most beautiful product. Here, in a huge mid-Manhattan office skyscraper lobby, Mr. Giuffre plays against the sound of footsteps.
Thank you. You just listened to three short pieces by American radio artist Tony Schwartz. The pieces in order were Favorite Sounds, How We Remember, and The Music in Marble Halls, with its famous duet for clarinet and high heels. For more information about Tony Schwartz, and links to many more pieces by him, and to learn more about other wonderful radio artists, please visit the Wave Farm Radio Art Archive at wavefarm.org.
Yeah, for some reason or another, you sound a little taller on radio.
This ever changed.